Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leaders Toolbox here on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews and I'm here today with our show's host, Richard Gassaway, fire chief in Roseville, Minnesota. Good afternoon, Rich, and as the year's coming down and we're starting our second year, this will be the 12th show. I'd like to wish you a happy holiday season.
Well, thank you, Pete, and thanks to all the listeners who've tuned into the Leaders Toolbox throughout the year and contributed comments and questions. We really appreciate it. That's the success of the program, is when you're writing in and giving us information where we feel like we're sharing valuable tidbits from the Leaders Toolbox that can help you on the job be better leaders and better providers of emergency services. Pete, before we start the podcast this week, I'm sure that many of the listeners don't know that I'd experienced a terrible tragedy here in Roseville with a death of my administrative assistant. And I just want to put out to those listeners in the fire service who extended their condolences to our department and to me personally during that time of tragic loss, how much that meant to me and members of my department to get the emails and the phone calls, and really made me feel as part of a bigger family, and how people who I know are very busy in their careers would take time to extend some kind words to our department. And I really appreciate that, and I want to extend a thank you to all of them. I'm not going to go through a list by names. I know I would forget somebody. There were so many flowers and cards and emails and phone calls. Thanks to everyone. Our department is healing slowly, and you know, time will help us be better, but we really appreciate that.
Okay, we were all very sorry to hear about that, and as you said, things are getting better, and unfortunately the tragedies in the fire service really seem to make everybody kind of realize how great the family of the fire service is, and I'm glad to see that you guys got the support that you needed. So
yeah, it was great.
Okay. For any of the listeners, the comments and questions, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll get to those on an upcoming show. Rich, we'll get into this show here. I know we have an interview coming up with Chief Buckman, John Buckman, from Indiana shortly, so we'll tackle the first question and then go into the interview. And this question is regarding alcohol in the firehouse, and we've seen this on the homepage of firehouse.com over the last few months. It's really seemed to take an elevated news level. Every week there's something where alcohol involved in a fire incident. This question comes in. It says, recently there was a news article about a Boston firefighter whose blood alcohol level was three times the legal limit, and this was found when he died fighting a fire. I'm embarrassed to say that our department still has beer in the station, and our members are able to drink and respond to calls. I'd like to know your opinion on this practice.
You know, alcohol and substance abuse in the fire service is truly becoming more and more of a public issue. We're seeing more of it in the headlines. We're seeing more of it on the websites like firehouse.com. And it's really a disturbing trend in our industry. And I hate to say a trend because I think the problem's been around for a while. But if we're going to become a profession that is respected in our communities, and I say a profession meaning career or volunteer or paid on call, we're all professionals. And if we're going to be respected as professionals in our community, then we have to step up and take responsibility of acting like professionals in our community. Let's take another profession, say a surgeon. If you were in an accident and they took you to the hospital and they were going to wheel you into surgery, and the surgeon comes up to talk to you about what the surgery is that they have to do to, say, fix your broken leg, and in the process of talking to you, the surgeon has alcohol in his breath, how comfortable are you going to be having that surgeon work on you? Not very comfortable, I hope. I mean, the fire service, people are putting their lives in our hands, the lives of their loved ones in our hands, their property in our care when we respond to calls, and we have a responsibility to do that in a safe and sober fashion. So long as you see headlines out there that says, you know, a firefighter was in an accident on duty or off duty under the influence of drugs or alcohol, we're going to continue to struggle to try to earn the community's respect as a profession. And don't think that when you see a headline of something that happens 5 states away, that doesn't impact you. It does. Somebody in your community is going to open up the newspaper or turn on the 5 or 6 o'clock news and see this headline, and then they're going to wonder, I wonder if that's happening in my community. I wonder if my firefighters that are going to come to my house when it's on fire or my medical emergency, if they're sober or if they're under the influence. So we really have to take a much stronger stance on this, a much more professional and mature stance on keeping firefighters sober. Alcohol in the fire station, that's another issue. It had to come up recently here in Minnesota. And then maybe a year ago, I read something where it came up in Wisconsin and some in New York where there's alcohol served in the fire station. And some of these places use this as a fundraiser for their fire department. And it's a means to get money to buy equipment. And I'm not opposed to that concept. What I am opposed to and believe the line is drawn is consuming that alcohol and then responding to calls. We all have choices to make. And you can choose in the fire station, outside the fire station, or at home to consume alcohol. That's your choice. It's a right that you're given. If you're of legal age, you can do that. However, with that choice also comes the choice to then not respond to emergency calls. So that you say, when I consume alcohol, I don't respond. Whether it's in the firehouse, at the firehouse bar, or if you're out with friends, or at home. If you've consumed alcohol, you don't respond. And there are model policies out there for alcohol usage in the fire service. The IFC has a model policy. Lots of fire departments are adopting policies that say if you consume alcohol, you do not respond to calls for a certain period of time. In my department, it's 8 hours. If you consume alcohol, then you don't respond to any calls or come to work until 8 hours has passed. So I would encourage departments to have a policy in place and communicate that policy to their members so that they know that you take it serious. I want to back up for a moment and talk about some of the logic of the alcohol in the fire station that was recently an issue here in Minnesota, where a city council actually voted to allow the fire department to have and serve and consume alcohol in the fire station. And they quoted one of the city council persons in the newspaper saying, "We trust our lives to the firefighters. I trust that they will know when they've had too much to drink to respond to calls." I'm going to pause for a minute because probably some of you are laughing as you listen to this. Think about, on a daily basis, how many people who should know they've had too much to drink get behind the wheel and then cause an accident that gets somebody hurt or killed. When you're drinking, you don't have your faculties and you don't have your logic. And for somebody to say, "I trust that somebody will have enough sense about them to know when they've had enough to drink that they won't respond to calls," that's ridiculous. And then the firefighters say, "Well, it's okay because the council has approved it, so we're okay to do this." This is a fire department that should police itself and make its own internal policy that says, you know what, there's a line here. When you drink, you don't respond. And if you want to respond, then don't drink. It's a conscious choice. And some of the, "Well, in small communities, you know, you've got to do something to get your members." Well, you don't need members who are coming to calls that are impaired. That is dangerous for everyone. It's dangerous for the customer. It's dangerous for the fellow firefighters. It's dangerous for the people on the street if that person gets behind the wheel and drives a fire department vehicle. I'd also heard once about a policy where the policy was, when we come to the fire station, I'll check you out and you check me out. And if you check out okay, I'll say you can go on the call. And if I check out okay, you tell me I can go on the call. Well, that's okay until you get two people that are impaired and both say, I look okay, you look okay, let's both get on the truck and go on the call, and they're both impaired. You know, the best policy is just zero tolerance for alcohol use and responding to calls. Like I say, we all have choices to make. And I enjoy having a drink with friends or wine with dinner, but when I do, I realize that when I take a drink, I have made a conscious decision that I'm not going to respond to calls for 8 hours. If you're from a department that says, well, you know, we just couldn't get anybody to respond to calls if we had a policy like that, then I'd say, well, maybe you're a department with some people who have a problem and they need to get some help about their alcohol use. Because, you know, it's okay to do things in moderation, but if you say, well, you know, every Friday night my entire department's out drinking, you know, maybe there's a problem. Or maybe you should get something where some of them agree to be on call, a certain number on call for a Friday night that agree that they'll stay, you know, sober so that the truck can get on the road and the calls can get answered. But ladies and gentlemen, alcohol and doing emergency services do not mix any more than alcohol would mix with a surgeon or alcohol would mix with a police officer on duty. There's just no place for it in our profession. There is no place for you to have alcohol in your breath and be in contact with customers or be impaired in trying to serve a customer or trying to protect the life of a fellow firefighter, or even worse, drive him down the road in the fire apparatus. So please, make wise decisions. If you choose to drink, don't respond to calls. If you're going to respond to calls, then choose not to drink. You're in control of this. Please make wise choices, and let's work hard to try to keep the fire service out of the headlines when it comes to alcohol use. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back just in a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Rich, we have an interview coming up here in just a second with Chief John Buckman. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I had an opportunity to interview John. He has been a almost iconic shaker and mover in the fire service. John is a very cutting-edge thinker, 30 years as a fire chief. Not 30 years in the fire service, 30 years as a fire chief. Volunteer chief, although he has a very good understanding of career issues, has been the past president of the International Association of Fire Chiefs, has traveled literally worldwide. The year he served as the president of the IFC, he told me he traveled almost 270 days that year visiting with fire service people from around the country and around the globe. And John has a tremendous positive attitude and a positive perspective on the fire service, and probably one of the finest speakers that I've ever had the opportunity to hear in a classroom setting. And just feel so privileged that John was able to take some time and sit down with the Leader's Toolbox and talk about some advice that he has for leaders in the fire service about how to be successful.
Radio at firehouse.com.
Welcome to this edition of the Leader's Toolbox. I'm in Washington, D.C. at the International Association of Fire Chiefs Leadership Summit, and I've been able to steal away John Buckman, past president of the International Association of Fire Chiefs and the fire chief in German Township, Indiana, just outside of Evansville, Indiana. Chief Buckman has a long and distinguished career in the fire service, including 30 years serving as the fire chief in German Township. So I've asked John to join us today to talk about some of the issues and the opportunities in leadership for fire service leaders, both current and upcoming. So welcome, John.
Welcome, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with having you perhaps pick a couple of the main bullet points of the essentials of good leadership. What things, if someone would say, well, the finest leaders possess these things, and that's part of the hallmark that makes them great leaders?
I think it comes down to a couple words. Vision is one of those words, and we'll talk more about vision. Integrity is critically important. Probably one of the most important things that a leader has is their word. And then committed. I mean, whether you're paid or not, when you're in a leadership position, you have to be committed. Not just to the organization, but to those people that you serve.
Okay. Let's take those three qualities that you mentioned, visionary leader, committed leader, and a leader with integrity, and maybe take each of those and spend some time with helping our listeners to understand why each of those components are so critical to a leader's success. Let's start with vision.
Any leader who wants people to follow them has to be able to give the followers some direction, some vision of where it is that they want to go, that the followers can buy into. It can't be too high a level, and it can't be too low a level. It has to be a way in which we're going to challenge those people, that we're going to give them something they can really put some work into, and that the end result is going to be that they actually see some progress, they see some change within their department. A visionary person is one of those people who can motivate people. Motivation is an important part of being of a visionary leader because, again, if I say this is what I want my fire company or my fire department to be, I'm not the one who's going to make that happen. It's a collective process that requires all of us to come together to help make that happen. Because if I'm the only one pushing for this fire department to be this, then we're going to fail. We're doomed to failure. The visionary part, the part about being a leader and a part about having a vision that I think is so critical is the buy-in part. You know, you have to communicate your vision, but you also have to ask for buy-in. I think that's one of those things that fire chiefs, many fire chiefs, and company officers as well, who have had some education, who have had some training, who have a vision, they don't ask people to help them. And I think one part of being a leader is that you have to ask people to help you. I need your help. I need your involvement. I need your commitment on what it is that I want to make this company, the direction I want to go, whether it's an all-volunteer company, becoming combination, whether it's changing the level of service, whether it's changing the type of services that we provide. It's great to have that vision, but if you don't have your followers buying into it, you're going to be a very frustrated leader.
Is there a process or a best practice for getting that buy-in from the group? You know, do you get them individually, or do you put them together as a group, or do you do it as a retreat? What's the best way to get everybody on the bus going the same way?
Well, all those ideas are great. I mean, from the retreat to the, you know, the department-wide to the individual communication, it's all about communications. It's all about written. It's all about verbal. It's all about body language. But I really think you do it from the bottom up. It's a lot more work to do it that way. You can have a retreat. Not too many fire departments can afford to do retreats. You can't do it in a volunteer fire company just in a business meeting because, you know, there's just too many issues coming up, confronting them. But if you can start by, you have a vision, and you can start communicating with one or two people within that organization and saying, you know, here's an idea I have. This is what I'd like to do. What do you think about it? And they're going to change some of your vision. You know, when you start, Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind. One of the seven principles that I really believe in. Because you don't start something without beginning with the end in mind. Well, the other part of that I think is important is that what you begin with will not be what you end with. If indeed you're going to have people to buy into it. Because if I just dictate to you and say, this is what I want and this is what you will do, in today's world, they're going to tell you, no, I'm not. They won't tell you that to your face, but they'll tell that to your back. So you have to get buy-in. And you do that on a one-on-one basis. You sit down across from the table and say, I have a vision. You know, you've been on this fire department 5 years, and in the next 5 years, this is what I see our community doing. This is what I see our fire departments doing. And this is the benefit. If you'll buy into this vision, this is the benefit that I see for you. I think the way to get vision buy-in is to make it personal with that individual. They have to see that what the benefit for them is. Is it more work? That's not going to help them. Is it better working conditions? Is it better wages? Is it less runs? You know, whatever it might be, you have to make it personal. So it is harder. But the other thing you do is you begin to, I'm not a real religious man, but you begin to build disciples. You get people to buy into this. And then it's sort of like the 12 disciples that worked for Jesus Christ. They carried the message. And today, religion is an important part of our life. It's the same thing in your fire department. You start out with one gets you another one, you get you another one, now we have four. Then that one gets you another one, then these two now get you another one, now we have eight. And so you quickly start to get people, and then you bring everybody together because they've all heard different parts of your vision. And you've modified your vision as you've listened to some people. Then you bring them together, but I think you sort of like infiltrate. And as long as it's not for your personal gain, I don't think infiltrate's a bad word. It's like manipulate. I think you're manipulating what they believe and what they see. And as long as it's not to make me richer, it's to make our department richer, I don't think manipulate's a bad word. But you're going to manipulate those people into buying into your vision. They're going to modify it some, but the end result's probably going to be if your vision is anywhere close to being on target, you'll probably get 60% of what you started with. But if it's not, and if the end result is that you only get 20% of what's your vision, then you weren't even close to being on the right page. And that may mean that you actually are not on the same page as the members of your department or the community. I think another important aspect of this vision, the implementation of your vision, is community input. I ask the question a lot, who has the power? In your community, who has the power? Most of the time people say, it's elected officials. I would tell you it's not elected officials. They say, well, then it's the people. And I'd say, nope, I don't believe it's the people. Who has the power in your community to influence your community? It may be the Chamber of Commerce. It may be churches. It may be neighborhood associations. But there is somebody that has the ear of the elected officials that can help them make the decision that you want. What I think part of this visionary selling process is that you get those people to buy into this. I think one of the challenges that leaders have, whether it's fire chiefs or company officers, is we only try to influence within our organization. We don't go outside our organization. I think that's critically important that we get people who pay the bill to tell us what they think. A good friend of mine who used to be the chief operating officer at FEMA, Ken Burris, once asked me, are you giving your community the kind of fire department you think they should have? Are the kind of fire department they're willing to pay for. And when you think about that, see, as a fire chief, I shouldn't be stuffing fire protection down their throats. I should be asking them, what are you willing to pay for? If you're willing to pay for a 3-minute response time, I can deliver it. If you want 4, 6, 8, 10, you want all volunteer home response, no guarantee of service, and that's what they're willing to pay for, then that's what you give them. But if you never ask them, if you never engage them in deciding the future of your fire department, the next thing you know, that fire chief is out there on a limb and they're pushing him farther and farther out, and next thing you know, he falls off and he breaks a leg and he never comes back to work.
Yep. And I'm going to add to that, John, and let you speak a little bit in more detail. In a previous fire department that I had worked on, we took the approach of going out and asking the community what they would like to have. And we did this in the way of a survey, and we were trying to improve our EMS response times. So we sent a survey out, which it had 8 or 10 questions. It wasn't very complicated, but we asked them if someone they cared about were having a heart attack and their heart stopped beating, how long would they expect it to take for the ambulance to arrive? We gave them a window of opportunities, like 2 to 3 minutes, 3 to 6 minutes, 6 to 9, 9 to 12, and we really expected that their response would come back something under 6 minutes because of what we know as trained professionals about what happens physiologically to the body after 6 minutes of no oxygen. And we were really surprised to see the average be about 11 minutes. So we didn't run with trying to provide a service that was 11 minutes because we knew that really wasn't going to provide good community service. But what we then had to do, though, is we had to retrack. We were trying to get a levy passed and embark upon a educational campaign to help those key community groups understand what 4 minutes meant, 6 minutes, 8, 10, 12 minutes meant in context of service and the consequences. And then we started to see a different response to the questions, because we were then asking them questions that they were informed about. And I think that that's an important component to add to that in asking them, is make sure that when we're asking them, that they understand what we're asking them.
Sure.
And what it means, because we really got our eyes open when that happened.
And I would agree with you. I mean, we've done some of the similar, maybe not as scientific a survey, but when you go to community groups and you talk to them, you say, how long do you think it's going to take for the fire department to arrive when you dial 911? Most of the time they'll say, oh, probably 10 minutes. And it's like, well, why would you think it'd be 10 minutes? It's like, well, we're pretty far away. We're a suburban area. In my particular fire department, we're a suburban area. They don't expect urban-type services. They don't expect 3 to 5 minutes. Just said, well, you know, that's probably it. Well, you know, we have a little better average response time than 10 minutes, but 10 minutes to them was not very long, and they didn't understand the consequences. And so you're right. When you educate them about the consequences, and here, if you want a 4-minute response time, here's the benefits of 4. And if you want 8, here's the benefits of 8, and here's the difference. And I think that's one of the... From a leadership perspective, as we're looking to the future, I really think this is one of the areas that the fire service needs to be able to quantify. I don't think, other than in emergency medical services, we cannot quantify the difference between 4 and 8 minutes. It's an emotional quantification, but not a scientific quantification. We can't sit here and tell you in a 3,000 square foot house where the fire starts in a bedroom, in 4 minutes, this is how much damage you'd have, and in 8 minutes, this is how much damage you have. We can tell you emotionally, but we can't tell you scientifically. We can't, there's not been, at least not that I'm aware of, tests that tell us. And then, okay, so if you get an 8-minute response time, you're going to have this much damage, and this is how much it's going to cost for fire protection. Well, if you go to a 4-minute response time, you're going to have this much damage, but the fire protection is going to cost you, but you save so much in insurance. I mean, I've never seen the circle completed. And I've asked this question of many people, even here in Washington, D.C., is how do we do that? And it's very difficult. There's lots of things that go into response times. There's lots of things that go into the amount of loss. New home, old home, you know, some with smoke detectors, some without, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's when you notice there's a fire. But I think at some point in time, and I hope it's not in the too distant future, that we actually see some kind of scientific analysis done to tell the public, if you get a 3-minute response time, this is what kind of fire losses you're going to have. We can tell you there's been enough scientific study to tell you if you have somebody there to do CPR in 4 minutes and a defibrillator in 8 minutes, what the save rate is. But I'm sure you, as well as many of the listeners out there, you know, probably make 15 codes with no saves to everyone, and maybe it's even worse. But, you know, we still try. I do think that even though you don't save the person, they don't live, just getting them to the hospital where they're still alive, or you're still trying, and the family being having a chance to say goodbye to a live body does so much good. And that's part of that emotional value that, again, I'm not sure fire chiefs fully understand all the public relations aspect, and I don't. I'm not even going to say that I'm one that does, but I think that we miss so many opportunities to tell the public the value of our service, and one of those is I've seen so many times, I can think in probably the last year, maybe as many as 6 times where people thank the fire department, send us notes for at least trying to save their dad, and that, you know, they were still working on him when they got to the hospital, and he at least got to say goodbye before they stopped all the life-saving, and just what it meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's a significant issue that we don't understand how to quantify.
Mm-hmm. Well, we tracked a little bit off of vision, but nonetheless, a real good discussion about some of the challenges that we face with trying to prove to the community the quality of our service, and when it especially comes to response times.
I've never been one to stay on target, Rick. So, I mean, We may have a problem here if we go very long. We may drift a couple times.
Yeah, that's all right, John. It's all good stuff. Let's move from vision into commitment and committed leadership and talk a little bit about why that's so important.
Well, it's very interesting to look at successful leaders and look at people who are not as successful at being a leader. And most of the time you can measure the difference in success by the amount of commitment. And by commitment, I'm talking about the amount of work you're willing to put in. I'm sure, just like I know you're involved in many things like I am, and people say, I just don't understand how you can do as much as you do. Well, it's about commitment. It's about, sure, there are sacrifices. My wife would tell you that she makes sacrifices, and she does, because I don't do some of the things that I could do with her or with my family. But if you're going to be really committed to the fire service, you got to have a supportive wife and a supportive family. And you know, you don't want to ignore them, but you have to commit to what your vision is. Where do you want to go? What's your personal development of where you want to see? What influence do you want to have? So I think, it is about work. And that means getting up early. I mean, I'm one of those guys who get up early and go to bed late. I know fire chiefs that you can call them 8 o'clock. It's like, well, they're not in yet. What time do you think they'll be in? Oh, probably 10. I'm like, okay, well, you call their cell phone. Oh, I'm still at home. It's 8:15. It's like, you're not going to influence a lot of things if you're sitting at home. You know, I think a good fire chief, Randy Brugman, who is now in Fresno, California, told me he said, I like to be the one to unlock the door so that when they come in, I'm already in there working. So he said, the next thing you know, they're starting to come in earlier because they don't want to be showing up an hour after the chief shows up. And I think that's important. And I'm not saying that you don't have a social life and you don't do fun things. I think that's critically important to being a well-rounded person. But work means going to work. I mean, my father taught me that a long time ago. He said, you know, although work should be enjoyable, it's not supposed to be fun. Work is supposed to be there for work. And I think the part about being committed is that you do need to have personal goals as well as professional goals, as well as organizational goals. There's all kinds of time management techniques out there. I'm a list person. I like to have lists. And some weeks, some days, I don't get anything off my list. I mean, I can look at my task list on my computer and go, when am I ever going to get something done? Well, I think one of the things that you can do as a leader is you quickly become negative and you start saying, well, I don't get nothing done. Well, at some point in time, do the time management study and actually quantify all the things that you do in a day. Because, you know, in my full-time profession now, I think, man, I don't get nothing done. Then I think how many meetings I went to, how many phone calls I answered, how many times staff came in with little questions. It's like, well, I didn't get anything tangible done, but I did get things done that I'm supposed to be doing as a leader, as the supervisor of people. So, you know, but what I really want to see is I want to see that concrete. I want to see that new policy statement, that new position paper. I want to see this new process we're going to go through, new program, new educational program. And so you become frustrated there. But again, I think that you need to have goals. And again, you need to have a goal every day. When you start out every day, I think you need to have three things that you want to get done for that day. And I want to tell you that you're not going to get all three of them done every day. But if you get one of them done, you've accomplished something. You've accomplished something that you wanted to do. That should be some personal satisfaction for you. That should make you think, I've done good things today. I've done something I wanted to do, as well as the organization might have wanted you to do. So I think that's important. I think the time management aspect of commitment is a critical aspect that we need to be better at. I recently went to a seminar called Getting Everything Done. And it was interesting to sit there. And I mean, they said some of the same things. But I think what I remember was that it is about creating a daily log, you know, of what you did all day. So when you say to yourself, I didn't do anything today, as you look at your daily log and go, I did do something today. I got those things done. I made 25 phone calls. And you know what, whatever it was, I sit in the mayor's office for an hour. Those are things that you are done. I think the commitment part is a frustrating thing for fire chiefs in many cases. I think we get down on ourselves. In fact, today you and I just listened to a presentation about being positive. And I think that's an important aspect of commitment, is your attitude. Is, you know, we all have challenges. We all have problems. But, you know, I see so many people. I see some of my staff that comes in 2 minutes till 8 and go, hey, how you doing today? Well, I guess I'm doing all right. It's like, what a crappy attitude. Mm-hmm. You know, when I wake up in the morning, I'm glad to be awake. I can't wait to jump out of bed. Now, I don't literally jump, I'm older now. But, you know, I can't wait to get up and look at the day. I got to have my recorder there because in the first 10 minutes when I'm awake, I'm thinking of all kinds of things I ought to be doing that day. So I always have my little recorder there. But I think your attitude is part of that commitment. I think how you look at your day, how you look at your life is part of that commitment because it all piles up on you. You know, I think the brain is sort of like the computer. I think you do have to turn the brain off ever so often. And there's nights that I'm sure you, just like me, you have a restless night. And you say, man, I didn't sleep at all last night. You know, I did this morning. I woke up about 4 a.m. I'll just roll over and go back to bed. Next thing, it's 7:45. It's like, man, I don't do this. But 4 a.m. was a little early to wake up when I didn't have a meeting till 8. But I think as a leader, you have to work at the commitment issue. You have to. I think one of the things that is maybe a little bit off the topic again, but you got to have mentors. You know, I have a great fire chief friend in Texas that I can call any time of the day or night. I can name all the names of the people who frustrate me and know that it'll never get back to anybody. And I think that's an important aspect of that commitment, because our jobs are frustrating. Whether you're in a career or a volunteer fire chief and a career combination or a volunteer department, things don't always go well. And so you need to have somebody that you can vent to that will give you advice, that will tell you when you're wrong. And you'll listen to them, because sometimes we do make bad decisions. And so I think that helps in that commitment, is having someone that you can vent to that will mentor you, that will give you good guidance, is a critical aspect of it. But I'm going to come back to the commitment part, and that is, it's about work. It really is about work. If you want to be successful as a chief, as a company officer, you got to work at it. You got to work at it every day. You got to work at it every minute of your work day. And I'm not going to tell you your work day is 24 hours, but you got to work at it. You got to be committed to it.
Excellent advice. I want to back up for a moment to when you were talking about lists, because as you were speaking, I was nodding my head, because I like to use lists also, and we have that in common. I didn't know that previously. But one of the things that I have found benefits me in using lists are, one, try to list big projects in increments on the list. Instead of, you know, today I'm going to climb Mount Everest, today I'm going to go buy a backpack, and tomorrow I'll buy hiking shoes, and the next day I'll, you know, hike a quarter of a mile on flat ground, and take those monumental tasks that we tend to put on our list and make them smaller bullets on the list, so as we get those incremental steps done, we can feel accomplished, versus looking at that huge mountain that seems like we're never even getting one step closer to climbing, but all the while we're accomplishing all these little things that are getting us one step closer to it.
And I will tell you that, and I've only had this about 3 months, but it's a Microsoft software called Mind Mapper. And it's just exactly what that is. It's almost like an org chart, but instead, you know, there's a variety of charts you can do with this thing, but it is to map a project out. It used to be, Microsoft used to have a software called Project Manager, and this is the next version, Mind Mapper 5.0. And so you take the climb Mount Everest, that's in the center. Well, here's what you got to do. You know, it's a two-year process. And then as you get this box accomplished, you make it red, or you even erase it. You just get it off there. And so you started out with 25 boxes, and now you only got two left, and you think, man, I'm going tomorrow. I only got two left. Tomorrow's get on the plane. And if you use this software, I mean, it's an excellent tool to help you visualize what you are, because I am a list person, but I'm also a visual person. Mm-hmm. I need to see what I got to do. I need to be able to map it out. And you don't necessarily have everything mapped in there. You may add things as you get into it, but it certainly has helped me visualize. I mean, we have a huge training program coming up here in a couple of weeks, and we've used the Mind Mapper there to all the things, all the different things, from having water there, to getting food, to getting the SCBAs, to getting the students, the hotel rooms, and all those things. And you're thinking, man, what do you got to do? Well, you use this Mind Mapper software, and you can list it all. You can put it all right there, and it's all attached, almost like an org chart, but it's all attached to that, to the center, which is November 8th, the start of the training program, 8 a.m., registration, class starts. And you know, so it does help you. So it's a great tool.
Kind of like beginning with the end in mind.
Absolutely.
And then it backtracks you to where you are in the current day to get to where you want to be, you know, at the top of the mountain at the end. That's a mind mapper. We'll put a link to that at the bottom of the podcast, and for anyone who might be interested in that software. Another thing about lists, John, that I have found is beneficial to me, and we're not going to dwell on that because it's not really our topic, but is when I accomplish something and I check it off the list, I don't throw that away. I might cut it from that list, but I'll paste it somewhere else so that at some point when I'm feeling down on myself, like I'm never getting anything accomplished, I'll pull out that B list, the done list, and look at all those things I've gotten done and how accomplished it feels every once in a while when you're saying, I'm not getting anything done, to look at that list and say, but look at all these things I did get done. And another thing I do is if I accomplish something for the day that wasn't on my to-do list, I put it on my list as done.
Sure.
So that I'm kind of keeping track as to the progress that I'm making. And for those chiefs that are very busy out there, if you're not using lists and you're not keeping track of what you're getting done, it's easy to get frustrated. It's easy to feel as though you're not accomplished. It's easy to get down on yourself that you're not committed because you are so focused on the day-to-day that you don't step back and say, look what I got done this month or the last 6 months or within the last year. And at some point you might be accountable to your manager to say, you know, what were your accomplishments? And ever since I started doing this process, John, when I meet with my manager and he said, what did you accomplish? I usually give them a list of so long, they say, pare that down. You know, we can't talk about that many things. So, you know, give me your top three or top five. Yeah. And it's hard to get it
or
down.
Or the big ones, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, even though this may not be the topic, it is about leadership. It is about commitment. It's about being able to get things done. Because when you look at the person who doesn't have a list, but gets up in the morning and goes, I got to do this. They put these two things in their brain. The phone rings 10 times. The secretary tells them to do something. They get two emergency calls. The mayor calls, and next thing you know, it's like, what was I going to do today? Mm-hmm. If you don't write it down, it's never going to get accomplished. You know, yeah. And I again, it's going to sound like an advertisement for Microsoft, but you know, I believe in the task list that's in the Outlook, yeah. In the Microsoft Outlook, and I'm the same way. I don't delete them. They go into the completed file, and if I ever wanted to list, you know, I do it by date. So if I want to print off what I accomplished in the month of October, I can go back and print it off.
Yep, good advice again. Well, we've touched on vision, and we've talked about commitment. Let's take the third leg of that stool that we started out with and talk about the importance of integrity.
That is such a huge issue that I'm not saying that there's probably anybody in this listening in this podcast that's never told a lie. I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, everybody on this world is perfect. But I think it's so critical when you get into a leadership role that you do your best at all times to tell the truth and to live up to your word. I mean, there's, you know, two things that your father gave you. One was your name and one was your word. And I think that's so important that people realize that if I tell a lie to one of my firefighters or to one of my bosses, it's going to, number one, it's just like your parents told you, they know you lied. You know, it's like your grandmother, you know, she told you probably when you were a little kid, Rich, that when you lie, I can smell it. And you believe that. And you thought, man, I'm not going to lie because she'll smell it. Well, I believe that if you lie to me, I will know it. And if you listen to law enforcement, they can tell you. They know when people are lying to you. It's a training issue. I have had some of that, you know, not to the extent like the Secret Service. They have a lot of techniques on how to tell if a person's lying. And I think it's something as a leader you need to understand, but it's so more important that you do not tell lies, that you honor your word, you honor your parents, you honor your commitment to your citizens, to your firefighters, and to your elected officials, that I'm gonna tell the truth, and you know, and own up to it. You know, when you make a mistake, if you didn't do it on purpose, you know, I told you that because I thought it was the truth and it wasn't, and I had got more information and it wasn't. It's sort of like being responsible. My father taught me to be responsible, take responsibility for my actions, take responsibility for my failures. And if one of my bosses listens to this, he'll know I'm talking about him. But one day, I have two levels of bosses above me. So my mid-level boss came to me and he goes, I'll use this title, the director wants to see you and you're in trouble. It's like, what? Well, you're doing this training program and you're supposed to do it this way and you're supposed to get this kind of money and you didn't do that. And I go, yeah, because that money wasn't available. And my father told me, take responsibility for your actions. So I walked in there and you know, this guy was ready to pounce on me. And he started talking, and after a couple minutes, I said, you know, sir, you are absolutely right. I made a mistake. I've learned from this. I will not repeat it. And there was silence from the other guy. Because it was the truth. I intended to do it the way he wanted me to, but I couldn't. I failed to inform him. It wasn't that I was lying to him or trying to mislead him. But when he called me on it, you're right, I made a mistake. We see so much. I think television is such a negative. Because you see so much television where doing things behind a person's back, doing things that is deceitful, that you're taught that in the end, they won. They lied, they cheated, they stole, but in the end, they became the hero. And I think that sends such a wrong message to our kids. I think television is, you know, I'm sure we're here on a podcast, but you know, I'm sure television won't like me saying that, but I think television sends such a negative message. I think parents send such a negative can send such a negative message to their children. I mean, I relate this story to my granddaughter Madeline when she was about 2 years old, and it relates to that habit. It relates to the leadership ability to lead by example. Madeline was about 2 years old, and she was at our house, and she lived with us for the first 2 years of her life. And she picked up the remote control, and she pointed it at the television. She couldn't make it do anything. But she had seen Mamaw and Papaw and her mom do that. And so she knew, she emulated us. And so from a leadership perspective, as it relates to integrity, if you lie, cheat, and steal, people are going to think it's all right. And they're going to emulate you. Madeline just taught me something right then. It's like, you know, you got to be real careful. You want to know why kids who grow up in a home where parents yell at each other and then they do the same things? Because they were taught that way. It's the same way with your firefighters. If you don't show up on time, if you're late, if you don't work hard, they're going to emulate you. I mean, if you don't go to training, if you don't get education, if you're not committed, they're not going to be committed. They're only going to work as hard as you work, or they're only going to work half as hard as you work. So if you only work half as hard, guess what? They're not even going to work hard. But I think the integrity issue doesn't just go to the lying, cheating, and stealing. It goes to performance. It goes to walking the walk, talking the talk, doing the things that you got to do in order to make sure that you lead a life, not perfect. I am not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but when I make a mistake, I admit it, but I try every day to lead by example, to do the right thing, to make the right decisions. I mean, as it relates to leadership, I've been a fire chief for 30 years, I think, as you said at the very beginning. I would tell you the commitment aspect of that, of doing the right things for the right reason, is very hard to continue to push for. I know that, you know, when I first started being fire chief, it's like, by God, the rules were the rules, and you didn't like it, you could get out of here. And I've caught myself where, here, you know, in later years, it's like more about, well, I want to be popular. I want to do the easy thing. I don't want to make you mad. And, you know, recently in my particular fire department, being a nice guy and sort of ignoring maybe some signs that were there, it's probably cost my fire department a considerable amount of money and will create some legal issues for the person that may or may not have taken some money from this fire department. And I look at that as an integrity issue for me, because I let my guard down, and I, even though I trusted this person with everything, including our lives, you can't be 100% trustful. You got to trust but verify. So when you give somebody a job and you trust that they're going to do it, you still got to ask. You still got to verify that they're doing it. You know, the leadership part of being a leader is that you got to ask the tough questions. You know, leadership is not about popularity. Leadership is about doing the right thing for the right reasons and making sure that people hold up their end of the bargain. I mean, if they're not going to accomplish something, they need to tell you, I can't do that. I mean, I have that issue with one of my officers the other day. I said, you know, you need to get this firefighter a new helmet. And he delegated that to a captain. So I called him the next day and said, did you get Jamie a new helmet? And he goes, I delegated that to the captain. I'm like, well, I wanted the captain to do it. I would just delegate it to the captain. Oh, well, okay, I'm sorry. I said, well, that's your issue. You're division chief. You issue the gear, and, you know, you're accountable for that. He didn't get mad, but that's a lot of times leaders don't want to confront people. And I think that's an integrity issue. If they know, I can push you. I can push you. You won't say nothing. And they know the level to which they push you and which you will not fight back. Because so many times as leaders, we want the thing to be smooth. We don't want any waves. We don't want any ripples. And I would tell you that there's ripples. And I'm trying to think, Stephen Covey, in one of his The Eighth Habit book that he wrote, he talks about permanent whitewater. Organizations are in permanent whitewater. And I really believe that. And as a leader, it's not that you want to make the whitewater worse. The whitewater is never going to go away. So you got to understand, we are constantly, we're jockeying for position. We're jockeying to get the things done. And if you accept that as a leader, that we're always in a permanent whitewater, that things are just never going to be perfectly smooth. It's never going to be like a lake and be it look like glass. Then as a leader, I can accept that. I can realize that I'm going to have to stir trouble up. I'm going to have to make things happen from time to time.
You had said back when you were talking about your example with Madeline, your granddaughter, have you ever found yourself in the presence of a fire chief who complained about his department or her department about their behavior, only to observe that this was also the behavior of the chief?
In other words,
the things they were complaining the most about their fire department doing, whether it's, you know, I'm surrounded by people who are nothing but whiners and complainers. And then you say, look in the mirror. You know, you're the biggest whiner and complainer I know.
It's monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
Monkey see, monkey do.
A learned behavior.
They
learn it from the chief.
Positive attitude is a very difficult learned behavior. I think a negative attitude is, we just heard a presentation about human nature or human behavior. I think being negative is an easier human behavior than being positive. I know years ago, I think I've made a transition. Again, I'm not saying I'm perfect, but now I look for the good things and not the bad things. Where before, I think 25 years ago, I was looking for the bad things. So I want to make you feel less and make myself feel more. And maybe that was because I wanted to, I was wanting to move up and I wanted to be, and the truth is that was a terrible leadership thing to do, is that you can't be negative. You have to be positive. The statement is that 90% of the people will do what you ask of them. But where do we spend the majority of our time? We spend the majority of our time on that 5 to 10% people who are a pain in the butts, who don't do what we want, and we ignore the people who do the things that we want. And you know what? When you ignore them, they want your attention. They quickly become a poor behavior or a bad behavior. And so I think you have to look at from a leadership perspective that when you go in there, that you are you're positive. I mean, again, my father, my father's dead now for 2 years, but I look back to him and he said, never let someone walk into your building without saying hi. And I try to do that. And people will walk in. If I'm on the phone, they'll walk in. And when our headquarters, you walk in the hallway, you can go to the right in the administrative office, or you can come in the left, go in the chief's office. And they'll just walk on in, go in the administrative office, and even though I'm on the phone, I even just say hi. And it's like, how can you do that? How can you not be happy to see me? I'm not going to jump on you. But how can you not be positive and thinking, wow, it's good to come to work. It's good to be at the fire department. It's great to come to training. It's just something that my dad told me, and I've tried to emulate him because I know that he did it. There wasn't times, and especially as kids or even as adults, that you'd come into the house, and he'd be sitting over in the chair. You'd come in the basement of our house, and he'd be sitting over in a chair. And I know parents that do this, that they just stay in the chair. Hey, how you doing, John? Good to see you. Glad you're here. Not my dad. My dad would get up out of the chair. No matter how sick he was, no matter how bad he felt, walk over, give you a hug, say, hey, son, it's good to see you. And it's from leadership, I think it's the same thing. If you walk into my fire station and I ignore you, I blow you off, what I've told you is you're of no value to me. Oh, but now I need something from you, so you're of value, so I'll talk to you. Now, wait a minute. Either you're valuable or you're not. And I think from a leadership perspective, you got to make that decision. And I would tell you, and even your worst employee has some value to you. And if you can't find that value, then you shouldn't even have them. You should be getting rid of them. And if they're that bad, if they're 98% bad, it's time to get rid of them, and probably for the 98%.
That's great advice, John. You spoke directly to me and hit a nerve with that last observation about your father, because I have found myself at my desk in my office, which is at City Hall, so busy in my work that when the shift crew stops by and comes into the office, I'm so focused on my work that I don't take the time to get up and greet them and thank them for being there and for the work that they do. I have taken that for granted, and I've learned something there, that there's an opportunity for me to show great appreciation. So for those in Roseville Fire Department who may occasionally listen to the podcast, my apologies for having overlooked how important that component may be, and I promise that I'll try to do better with that.
I think what you do, you and what you've just talked about is what many fire chiefs do, is we get tied down into the task, not into the people. Which is more important, the task or the people? And, you know, we've both been to management school and leadership school, and the people are what's more important, because without people, you can't do the task. But it's a habit we fall into, or it's, you know, something that just happens. And until you recognize that, or until you have somebody beat you over the head with it, you go, wow, yeah, I didn't realize that. Because, you know, think about the same thing that you do. I mean, my boss at my full-time job is a great guy. And, you know, if I come in, I'm usually there before he is. But every morning, he will walk around to see everybody in the office. He doesn't have to do that. It takes him 5 or 10 minutes, or maybe it takes him longer than that, because sometimes he'll talk substantive issues. But I realize and think what he's doing is saying, I'm here, you guys are here, you're valuable to me, so I'm at least going to spend some time coming and talking to everybody, even though some of them are not his direct reports. You know, there's different levels of supervision. But I've noticed that, and it how it makes me feel as an employee. I was like, wow, it's great. I mean, even you know, the executive director, because I'm not in my office in Indianapolis every day, there's been times when my office door is open and the executive director comes over and says, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Glad you're here. And you know, then we'll talk about a couple issues, and I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The big boss comes and sees you, mm-hmm. You know. So even though you think, oh, I'm more busy, I got so much to do, I need to spend time doing this task, when, you know, put yourself in those people's position of, like, just coming down, shaking their hand, saying hi, how's things at home, how's your family? I've learned those are questions. You know, ask the question that will get them to elicit a response from them. Ask them about their wife. Ask them about their kids. Long time ago, and again, I'm not real good at this, but I think it's so critically important that you understand what's going on in your people's life. Not to the point where you know what, you know, it's not a gossipy kind of thing, but it was big things in their life. It's really important. Chief Smokey Dyer, many years ago, when he was going through the chairs at the International Association of Fire Chiefs, he's sitting there. I don't think he was president, but he was sitting there, and he's writing things on cards, and I go, what is that? And he goes, it's birthday cards. I said, and he's the chief of the Kansas City Fire Department. He goes, yeah, I send birthday cards to my members, handwritten birthday cards. That's been about 8 years ago, and I try to do the same thing. I mean, if you watched yesterday,
I saw you writing cards.
That's what I was doing. You know, I have a wad of cards with me that, you know, I think of all the people I need to write and thank, and it's amazing the dividends that pays. And people, I mean, I have this thing about birthdays. Like, you know, we now know Greg Cade's birthday, the U.S. Fire Administrator. Next year, he'll get a birthday card from me.
Well, I felt guilty because I was sitting there listening to the speaker, and I could kind of see out of the corner of my eye, and you were listening to the speaker, but you were writing a lot, and I thought, my gosh, he is taking a lot of notes with what this speaker is saying. So I kind of glanced over and saw that you were, you know, doing some kind of multitasking, both, you know, giving the speaker their due, but also sending out what appeared to be some thank you cards or notes of encouragement, yeah, to people.
And I know you have them, because, I mean, I've seen the card Roseville has. Because, mm-hmm, I mean, we use that in the VCOS leadership course. And I think it's just another thing to show value. It's another thing to show that person is important to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if you miss your anniversary, you're in trouble. Well, it's not that if you miss one of your firefighters' birthdays, you're in trouble. But if you recognize their birthday, it's going to pay you dividends. They're going to think, wow. One, they're going to think, how'd you know my birthday? Well, you know, with Outlook today, you can put your birthday on there one time and put it on there and never ends. Yep. I mean, it was just Rich Marinucci's, the chief in Farmington Hills, Michigan, birthday this week. And, you know, called him up and wished him a happy birthday.
Well, I had, you know, on that line, today is two of my firefighters are getting married to each other. And I was invited to the wedding, but unable to attend because we're here in Washington. But just about 2 hours before the wedding, I made sure that I knew he'd have his cell phone. And I sent him a text message just wishing them well, telling them that I wish that I could be there to attend their wedding. And he sent me I'm going to get my phone out here. He sent me a text message back that said, "Thank you for the kind words. They mean more to me than you would ever know."
Absolutely.
You know, and here, it's his wedding.
Right.
And he's
took
saying
time.
That these words mean more to him than I would ever know. You know, and it's his wedding day. It,
right.
You know, it wasn't a...
And it did because he took the time to tell you. See, that's the message there. Is he could have just went, blown it off, but he took the time to respond. That just adds to you the value that meant to him. So yeah. it is important. And that it is, you know, text messaging is one of those ways, sending emails. I would tell the listeners out there, don't send emails. If you want to recognize somebody important, don't send them an email. Get the postage stamp and stick it on an envelope and do that. So it's because it's, you know, cost you a buck by the time you buy, you know, if you have fire department cards. And I think, as Smokey Dyer told me, handwritten is what it's about. Don't send them something. Sure, you can go to the card store and buy a card, but that's not what's important. What's important is you send them a handwritten card.
Yep. Even with all the technology available today, there's few things that probably can be equal to either personally telling somebody face-to-face thank you or taking the time to handwrite them a note telling them how much you appreciate something that they've done. And it just speaks, again, to the integrity of a leader who will go out of their way to give that credit to where the credit is due.
Some people would say that that's manipulation, and I would tell you, yes, it is. It is manipulating them to feel good about being engaged with that leader. It's manipulating them to do more things for what you want them to do, but it's not a negative. Again, this manipulation word, I've used it for many years, and many people think of it as negative, but I'm manipulating you to feel good about your involvement with the fire department, to feel good that your leader would recognize it. And the end result is going to be, I'm going to want something from you, but I'm not going to want something from me personally. I'm going to want something from you, either from you personally to improve yourself, increased education, increased involvement, and I'm going to end up helping the fire department. And that's really what a leader needs to do. A leader needs to get the things out of the people that he or she needs in order to make the fire department more effective.
You know, it kind of reminds me, you'd given some examples of when you were growing up, and obviously you've had some wonderful role models with your father. I think about when I was growing up, we didn't eat out very often. And, you know, my mom was the kind of person who felt that the family should always, you know, sit down together and have a meal and rarely ate out. But when we did eat out, those rare few times, they always made a really big deal out of it. We got to have dessert and really felt good. You know, you felt like it was really something special. And I kind of liken the thank you cards and the notes of thanks. You had called it manipulation in a positively stated way. But I think it's kind of like the equivalent of having a meal out with a dessert that, you know, that mm-hmm. didn't have to happen.
Right.
But because it did, you really feel special and you feel as though that you mean something, you know, special to the person who
right.
took the time to take you out or to get you the card. So I think that form of manipulation in the way of reward and recognition is essential to a fire chief's success, and it isn't something that should be looked upon, you know, with disregard or in bad light. We've been at it almost an hour, and I cannot thank you enough for the gift of this amount of time, knowing how busy you are here at the Leadership Summit and with all the other people who are tugging to have time with you. I appreciate you sitting down with me to share your thoughts on leadership, especially vision and commitment and integrity, with the podcast listeners. So, Chief John Buckman from Washington, D.C., thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Rich. It's been great. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.